On today's show, we talk about the Milwaukee Brewers making a push, the St. Louis Cardinals pushing back, and Tyler Glass now going to the minors. Plus, one of us pledges our allegiance to Mike Matheny. This is the DFA Podcast. Welcome to the latest episode of the DFA Podcast. I'm your host, RJ Anderson from CBS Sports. Ryan Grosnick is on assignment in Arcadia, so today I'm being joined by our designated pinch hitter, Zach Kreiser. Zach, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm back. I'm an author of Baseball Prospectus, formerly of Beyond the Box Score, and apparently frequent guest host of this podcast. So,
yes, and that's a very, very special role to be in. We're also joined by our usual producer, Mr. Sean Brody. And since we just talked about two impressive newcomers to the baseball writing game, we might as well transition to two impressive newcomers to a first-place team's roster. We're talking about the Milwaukee Brewers. The Milwaukee Brewers promoting left-hand pitcher Josh Hader and outfielder Lewis Brinson to their active roster over the weekend. These moves are designed in part to boost their bullpen, as Hader will pitch in relief, at least for the time being, and Brinson is around to help replace the offensive loss suffered not only with the Ryan Braun injury, but the Jonathan Villar injury and Travis Shaw being on the family emergency list. So there's some concern there. Zach, what do you make of these moves? Is Milwaukee going for it? Are they just trying to make the most of their season, or is this just about getting a look at some youngsters, getting them some big league experience while they can?
I think it's probably a mix of all of those things. I don't think you're going to see Milwaukee go and make some big move to try and capitalize on their current standing. I think just from the way we've seen that front office operate, we know that they are not going to jump the gun, probably. I mean, one of their best moves was kind of taking advantage of Houston jumping the gun a couple of years ago when they picked up Domingo Santana. And I think you're probably seeing Hader and Brinson come up as opportunities where the roster made it possible. I think especially Brinson, with the way their lineup is stacked right now, I don't think you'll see him up for all that long. I think he's probably just a cup of coffee to see how he looks, unless he forces his way into the lineup. I think he'll head back down. Hader's more interesting. Obviously, their pitching is not great. And the other thing with Hader is that he's been marooned at Colorado Springs this year, and that has not been going well. He already had kind of a walk issue. His walks weren't great, but he's gone to Colorado Springs and with a home run problem there has also kind of developed a larger walk problem. It just seems like that's not really the place for him. And so I think it's interesting if maybe they want to try and keep him in the big leagues, first in the bullpen right now. Maybe they'll transition him to starter later, or maybe they'll send him back down to Double A. I just don't really think Triple A has been good for him, and it'd be interesting if they tried to keep him away from there and get him back to where he was rolling through Double A really, really well. At the beginning of last year, he had 57 innings in Double A with a 0.95 ERA. So I think there might be a little more intention to keep Hader around, but I think Brinson's probably just a look at what might be a super high potential guy, but probably not here to stay right now.
Yeah, that makes sense. And this is a Milwaukee team that I believe they're going to be starting Paolo Espino for a third time this week, and he's a 30-year-old rookie. He's bounced around the minors. So, if you're just looking at this roster, Hader certainly seems like he has a chance to slot into the rotation, especially once he gets away from, that Triple A environment, maybe gets some confidence back, maybe sees that, he doesn't have to nibble or whatever anymore. He's able to come right after hitters with that fastball-slider combination and get them out. So I think you're right that this is about putting him in a more favorable environment and allowing him to get back to what made him successful before. And with Brenson, we're recording this on the morning of the first day of the first-year player draft, and I just want to note, he's been a really fascinating prospect to follow because I remember when he was drafted, I remember watching video of his swing and just being like, man, this dude, you know, he's really going to have to undergo a lot of tweaking, a lot of developmental work. And his first full season, it was 2013, he struck out in 38% of his plate appearances. And, you know, everybody knows the hit tool is the most important tool. If you can't hit, you're not going to reach the majors. And there was significant reason to think, okay, he might be in trouble. Even though he was young, even though he had all this athleticism, all these physical traits that lend themselves to being a successful ball player, you can't strike out that much, especially in A ball, and expect to have a good career. Well, you watch his swing over the years. You know, you can go on YouTube and punch him in and look for his swing over the years. And you really have to tip your hat to the Rangers coaches and to Brenson because he's really sliced into his strikeout rate. You know, he's improved his ability to make contact, and he's overhauled his swing. And that's not easy to do. And it's especially not easy to do when you have the expectations you place on yourself from being a high draft pick. It's not easy to do when it's your livelihood at stake. So, you know, he deserves credit. They deserve credit. And, you know, I'm rooting for him. He has a very interesting backstory, and I can't wait to see him play at the big league level. And I can't wait for him to get a full-time big league gig so we can see him every night. So, yeah, I find that really interesting. And, you know, let's just talk about this Brewers team in general. Are you buying them as a legitimate contender at this point?
Well, I've been going around at the beginning of the season. I have another baseball savvy friend who I have a steak dinner riding on the Brewers. I bet him that they would win 80 games. So I was buying them as a decent team before the season started, just because I thought the lineup was stacked and I thought they could figure it out enough. I didn't ever really think they were going to trade Ryan Braun, which now he's hurt. So, but to the extent that I think they can hang around and maybe even finish second in this division at this point, yes, I buy that. I don't buy them making the postseason or really having much of a challenge for the Cubs by the end of the season, but I do think they're extremely well set up for the next few seasons. I think their rebuild has been, maybe it hasn't gotten as much attention as some of the ones that came before it, or even some of the ones in bigger markets like the Phillies. And but I think it's been extremely intelligent and well done. I mean, they've acquired we always talk about how when you are looking at like the draft tonight, it's going to be all up the middle players. It's going to be everyone starts out playing catcher, shortstop, center field. Everyone's a young, hard-throwing pitcher. That's basically all the Brewers have acquired. They've acquired multiple catchers. They've acquired multiple shortstop and center field prospects, whether it's, you know, the Eason Diaz? I'm messing up his name, I think. The guy they got from the Diamondbacks that turned into a second baseman, Eason Diaz, yeah, and is just tearing up the minors. And then they also got Mauricio Dubon in the deal with the Red Sox. And they obviously acquired Brenson in trade. It's just been a very smart rebuild. And if they have even some of these guys pan out, they're looking at star players as opposed to just pieces. And I think it's really, really, really great. And Brenson is obviously a huge part of that. We also have to talk about him in relation to Colorado Springs, because his 312 average this year is being boosted by that a bit. And so you're probably going to look at him coming back down into the 240s or something, if I had to guess, yeah, in the majors. But it's still, his walk rate is way up from where he used to be, and his strikeout rate obviously is down in the 22% range, which is very playable today. So I think they've done a really great job with their rebuild, and I'm not buying them as a postseason contender this year, but I do buy them going forward.
That makes sense. And if you do go through the roster, I mean, so much of this team was assembled through trade. You know, Bandy was a trade acquisition. VR was a trade acquisition. Shaw, Broxton, Santana. I don't remember if Hernan Perez was a trade acquisition. I think he was a waiver claim. Same with Aguilar. You know, And we haven't even mentioned, and of course, Phillips and Brinson and Hader, they were all trade acquisitions. We haven't even mentioned the most important move they've made over the last year plus. And I think you know who I'm talking about. You know, he's shown surprising power during his big league stint. He's a little older. We didn't really suspect he would do this, but, you know, Eric Sogard, 333, 455, 542 in his first 88 plate appearances. I mean, Eric Thames, who? Yeah, Eric Sogard. You don't need Eric Thames to be as good as he was earlier in the season. So, yeah, they've really been impressive, and I'm not necessarily buying them as contenders either, but I do kind of buy the idea that they might go out and, you know, add one piece for an excess prospect or what have you, just to, you know, just to give their team a better chance at perhaps stealing a wild card spot and give them a little confidence going into next season, which is when I think a lot of us expected them to rise from the ashes again. So it's a good story. It's a fun story, and it's looking to be a fun summer in Milwaukee. And the team, the Brewers are going to play next, just so happens to be the next team we're going to talk about. They're about to begin a three-game series against the St. Louis Cardinals, and over the weekend, the Cardinals did something that very few of us anticipated. They designated Johnny Peralta for assignments. So, Zach, I just want to ask you, did you see Johnny Peralta getting designated for assignment before the middle of June?
No, I did not. I also did not see him going this long without an RBI or an extra base hit. Man, he has been oof.
Right, and it fell apart pretty quickly because even last season, I believe he had like a 91 OPS plus, and you know, that was with some injuries, that was with missing time. This season, he's been horrendous. And the Cardinals, it's funny because if you would have thought about this a few years ago, when they signed this Peralta contract, we were all like, did they just overpay this guy? You know, what are they doing? And then he had a few good seasons, and it was like, you know, this is actually a really smart deal. And if you would have told me 2 years ago that the reason the Cardinals would be able to designate Johnny Peralta for assignment this season would be because of the play of Diaz and Jed Jerko, I would have said, like, what are you talking about? Because, you know, Diaz was thought of as a utility infielder at best, and Jerko, I mean, who even knows what was going on with him in San Diego? He wasn't hitting. He didn't seem to be a great defensive value. And, you know, thankfully, my man Greg Garcia has also played a little bit of a part in that, you know, his versatility. And sometimes his bat, but obviously he's not hitting too well overall, but, you know, utility infielder profile. So, yeah, I'm a little surprised that they did pull the string so early. And I found Tommy Pham's comments after the news pretty interesting because Pham, he kind of took a shot at the rest of his team, or at least there was a semblance of a shot there. He said that Peralta was someone who just showed up to play baseball. He didn't take part in the chess games, the ping pong games, the video games. He just showed up to do his job, and that he would miss Peralta's presence in the clubhouse. So, you know, the Cardinals have obviously struggled this season. As of now, they're 29-32, which is only like 3 games back in the division, 2.5 games back, I think. So they're not out of it by any means. But what does it say to this Cardinals clubhouse that they went and designated seemingly this professional, formerly pretty productive player in the middle of June after 58 plate appearances? I mean, what does it say? You know, are they trying to send a message here? Or is this a case where the Cardinals front office said, you know what, Peralta's cooked. Let's move on to younger, perhaps superior options and not have to worry about, you know, massaging Peralta's ego or getting him into the lineup to validate that contract or what have you. Did they just want to take the human aspect out of playing time, or is this about giving the rest of the roster a jolt?
I think I don't know exactly what the front office was thinking in making the move, other than that he was, I mean, just so obviously a weak link. But it's interesting how apocalyptic this 3 games under .500 feels for the Cardinals. I know they lost, like 6 or 7 in a row to get there, so there were some dark clouds. But it felt so grim, that press conference they called and everything to shuffle the deck chairs a little bit, like move what they got rid of the third base coach. I mean, that's just not something you usually call a press conference for. And I know they also DFA'd Peralta, but that's also not something you'd usually call a press conference for. It feels like they're trying to make a show of this is not acceptable for us, which is strange. I don't know. It doesn't feel like a thing many other teams would do. And it's interesting. I mean, getting rid of Peralta is not even that big a deal. They have a billion third and second base types who can shift around and plug in on offense or defense pretty well, at least as long as Jed Jorko continues with the whatever deal with the devil he made. And it's just a strange, they could very well be right back into like second place and contending for the wild card within like a week.
Yeah.
But there's all this stuff, and everyone kind of thought Matheny might be on the hot seat and various things. I do think getting rid of Peralta might be a quicker trigger because they didn't know if they could get Matheny to bench him consistently. That's probably a very Matheny problem, but I don't think the panic that they have seemed to exude is necessarily valid. I think it's more a product of how sustainable their success has been, and it's just a little bump in the road, but I don't think there's anything to panic about in St. Louis, at least unless they want to go ahead with my suggested plan of making Yadier Molina player manager and getting a spot for Carson Kelly in there, kind of.
That seems unlikely, but let's talk about Matheny just a little bit more. Do you think he gets fired before the season's over?
I don't think he ever gets fired.
Never. Never ever?
I think that whenever he leaves, it will be some sort of jerry-rigged, like, he steps down and someone else takes over. I don't think he'll ever be technically fired.
The Robin Ventura treatment then. Okay, so let's just spawn this out a little bit. Which manager do you think will get fired this season, if any? Like, is there one manager on your mind here just like, you know what? He is going to be dismissed before the next, I don't know, month or so is up.
Hold on, I gotta look at
this. I wrote an article for CBS on, I believe it was Saturday, and I came to the conclusion that if a manager is going to get fired, it's going to be Terry Collins. Because you have, for one thing, the Mets factor. You know, they're always prone to making a PR mess out of nothing. For another thing, you know, they've been disappointing. Collins is in the final year of his contract. He's already kind of hinted that he's going to retire after the season, which means they don't have to worry about, oh, you know, what if we wanted to bring him back for another year, whatever. They were probably looking for a manager anyway, so, you know, they get a head start on that. And, you know, in the past, I believe it was in the Baseball Maverick book, Alderson is sort of professed to not be a huge fan of Terry Collins, and I think he would prefer having a more progressive manager, which I think the Cardinals front office would probably prefer to have a little bit more progressive manager as well. So, yeah, I think if a manager is going to get fired in the next month or two, it's going to be Terry Collins. But I guess I was just curious, you know, is there someone else out there I'm missing, or would you agree that it's probably going to be Collins if someone does go?
If someone does go, yeah, I kind of have to agree with you. Because if you look at the other teams that are either disappointing or running into some sort of boondoggle of a season, you're looking at like the Phillies, who probably don't have enough motivation to make a move, the Pirates, who aren't going to move Clint Hurdle, he's clearly not the problem, the Giants, who would never fire Bochy, the Padres are the Padres, the Royals aren't going to move Yost, and I don't think, that's about it. I think the Mets are kind of the clear contender where there might be where the manager move might be something they'd resort to. But the Cardinals are obviously an option. I have this theory that they like to keep their little dream world intact and that they wouldn't fire franchise icon Mike Matheny.
We all like to keep our dream world intact, Zach. And that's probably a good place to transition to the segment where our dream world is vigorously attacked by Mr. Brody. So, Sean, would you like to lead us into our round of batting practice by introducing the first small move of the day?
So we'll stick with the Cardinals and Mets theme of Terry Collins being fired. And Sean Gilmartin was designated for assignment by the New York Mets and claimed by the St. Louis Cardinals. So how many innings do we think Sean Gilmartin gets? And does the Cardinals' devil magic work on him?
I'm going to say 15 innings for the rest of the season because, you know, he's a lefty. He's had some big league success, not a whole lot, and I know it was limited to his rookie season, but some big league success. He seems like the type will come up. I don't know if it'll be a spot start or whatever, but he can come up and, you know, eat three or four innings if needed and then disappear again. And he can do that a few times until September. But 15 innings, I don't think the double magic will affect him either way. And I think that'll be all she wrote on Sean Gilmartin's 2017. What about you, Zach?
I just had to look up Sean Gilmartin's previous seasons to make an educated guess here. I know that you know, the Cardinals got Matt Bowman, who's a surprisingly good reliever, off of the Mets. And Sean Gilmartin's just never – he hasn't struck out 10 batters per nine in any stop since, like, nine innings in rookie ball. And I don't feel great about that. Maybe 20 innings because they have a bit of a mess, but I don't think the devil magic will have any noticeable effect.
So from a guy that was on the Mets and goes to the Cardinals, we now go to a guy that was on the Cardinals and now goes to the Mets. That's Daniel Bard. He was signed to a minor league deal by the New York Mets, and the descent of Bard into nothingness is kind of sad. He's been middling in double A, single A, high A for the last 3 years, after coming back from, I want to say it was Tommy John. Last time he saw any time in the bigs was in 2013 with the Red Sox. And do we think that he is going to be able to get back at all?
No. Unfortunately, there was some hype during the spring that he had, you know, transformed his mechanics. He was obviously still throwing hard and, you know, still had his stuff and all. But, man, look at his numbers this season. In double A, through 8 2/3 innings, only allowed 6 hits. That seemed fine. Allowed 10 runs because he issued 19 walks. 0 were intentional. He also hit 2 batters and uncorked 4 wild pitches. I just kind of wonder how many more teams are going to sign him because he's going to be 32 in about a week's time, maybe a week and a half's time. And, you know, he, like you said, Brody, he has not pitched in the majors since 2013. It didn't go particularly well in that inning. He hasn't really been an effective big league pitcher since 2011. It's probably time to give up the ghost on Daniel Bard ever re-reaching the majors, let alone reaching the majors and having any kind of success whatsoever. So it's sad, but yeah, I think it's time to say this one's not happening.
Yeah, it's a really unfortunate turn of a career where a guy just it's not even like Rick Ankiel where he could go do something else and have that inspirational bit to, you know, to end the story. But, it's probably over at this point.
And you look at his stats, he actually has not struck out more batters than he has walked since 2012 in a stint in AAA with the Red Sox. And that's got to mess with someone's psyche, you have to think, right? I mean, to go out there and consistently walk more hitters than you strike out and to kind of see these struggles elongated over a six-year period of time, it's rough. You have to wonder how much longer he's going to try to stick out with it.
I don't know how he's done it this long, honestly.
So moving forward now, we'll stick with the Mets for a little bit longer. Steven Matz and Seth Lugo off the disabled list. Will the Mets climb back into this thing at all this season?
I doubt it. I mean, if you just – okay, they're 9.5 games out in the division. You know, the Nationals have had some hiccups, but realistically it's hard to see the Mets catching fire to the extent that they're, you know, in the division race. Or, you know, I mean, I guess it's possible, but it's unlikely. Let's put it that way. And the wild card race isn't going to be much easier. I mean, you have to think that the Dodgers are going to claim one of those spots, but the Diamondbacks have 7 fewer losses than the Mets at this point. The Rockies, even if they slip a little bit, have 9 fewer losses than the Mets. We're not even talking about the National League Central, and we have 2 teams already that are well ahead of the Mets in the wild card race. So maybe they get closer. I don't think they're going to realistically be a contender for a playoff spot, however.
you really just have to, if they want to get back in it, you, then the Nationals aren't going to collapse, probably, famous last words, but the Nationals aren't going to collapse. The Dodgers are the Dodgers. So you really have to, if you're a Mets fan, hope that the Rockies or Diamondbacks collapse, or that they just get a little worse and decide that it's not worth going for it, something like that.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the Rockies. I think the Rockies are in it and will be there. They're doing all this without their best pitcher. I just don't see the Rockies falling out of it. The D-backs I could see coming back to earth and maybe deciding that they're not going to go all in on the season, whatever that means. But I it's still a long way back for the Mets to catch up to the D-backs, even if the D-backs play at a 500 pace the rest of the way and the Mets elevate quite a bit, it's a really tough road.
Yeah, and I mean, the Mets still have significant issues of their own, and those aren't just going to go away just because, you know, they've got Lugo and Mats back. So, yeah, I'm not buying them being a realistic playoff contender, even if I do buy them being a little bit better than they were this time last week.
You talk about getting Mats and Lugo back. You got Yoenis Cespedes back. They still have Ahmed Rosario in the minor leagues for some reason. I don't know if he has, like, a... Like one of those giant balls with a chain attached to him, and he has to stay in the minors. But you have to think that just because players come back from injury, that they're also going to be susceptible to further injury at some point in the year. So whether they're going to be able to stay healthy through September is really, really a big question. And they would have to outplay essentially the Cubs and the Cardinals to get in, because like y'all said, I don't really see the Diamondbacks and the Rockies just falling in on themselves, but it's an uphill climb. And so we'll move forward to a team in the American League looking to climb back into it, and that's the Seattle Mariners. Mitch Haniger came off the DL from a hip impingement. James Paxton recently come off the DL. They should be getting Gene Segura back soon, Felix Hernandez, Hisashi Iwakuma. Is this the team that gets healthy, comes back, and takes a wild card spot?
I think I'm on the record from this podcast last week saying they are. So I'm going to stick my neck out again and say I still like them as a contender for the second wild card in the AL. I think if the cavalry is coming and if they can just keep Paxton and Haniger healthy and maybe one other pitcher with actual major league innings under his belt, then I like them. That division is not great. I don't think the Twins are for real, so you're looking at Cleveland jumping up eventually and taking that division, and then the Mariners just have to outrun the troutless Angels, the regressing Twins, and the Rays, and the Orioles might not have any pitchers. So I think the Mariners are a good contender for the second wild card. I'm not gung-ho in saying I think they're some sort of lock. I think they've got a really good chance at it. I think their lineup is probably the best single thing on any of these teams that they're competing with. So
yeah, I mean, all those teams have flaws, and the one thing I'm concerned about with the Mariners is sort of what we just talked about with the Mets, in the sense that, you know, once you've suffered an injury, it seems like you have a decent or an improved chance of suffering another injury. And that entire rotation has suffered injuries, and, you know, being without Segura for close to 2 months is going to hurt. And yeah, I just don't buy them being necessarily the best of those teams, because I'm really concerned that their roster, or their intended roster, is not going to be the roster they have due to injury. So I do accept that they are a legitimate contender for a wild card spot, but it's hard for me to put a lot of faith in them because I am scared witless over their injury situation and their potential injury situation.
Yeah, the interesting thing is if the Twins do stay in it long enough and maybe make some sort of small move to shore up their pitching, or if the Blue Jays get really hot and come back, there's a lot of things that are just totally up in the air in the AL. But as the teams currently stand, there are worse positions to be in than the Mariners, but yes, their health is an issue.
So from the Mariners, who got they sent away for Drew Smyly, and that's Malik Smith. Kevin Kiermaier is injured. He went to the disabled list, and Malik Smith has been taking his place in his absence. But Malik Smith has been hitting the ball very well, better than Kiermaier was, and he's also been playing better defense. Which is weird to say for Kevin Kiermaier, who is thought of as a defensive wizard. Did anybody see Malik Smith doing this?
I'm still really not sold on his bat. I know he's got good numbers, but there is a lot of swing and miss in his game for a dude whose game is really primarily based on making contact and drawing walks. You know, he's never going to hit for a lot of power. The swing isn't just conductive to that, and you know, he's just not modeled to hit for power. So I'm still sort of a pessimist here. I know I've used this example before, but I always think, you know, is this dude Sam Fold or is he Brett Gardner? And I get Sam Fold vibes from Malik Smith. And that's not, you know, that's not a huge insult because Sam Fold had a decent big league career. It's just I'm not really certain that he's going to be an everyday player. I'm definitely not certain that he's going to continue to hit 378 or whatever he's hitting right now. I think it's more likely he settles in as a useful reserve outfielder who can play defense, who can run, who can lay down a bunt, and who can occasionally have these little spurts where, you know, the balls are getting through holes and the bloopers are landing or whatever, and he looks like, you know, he's a spark plug, top of the lineup kind of guy. But I'm not sold on him being this good, and I'm not sold on him being good in general, I suppose.
Is it possible he's something in between, like a Jerrod Dyson type, but without
the arm?
No,
that's not how we play these games, Kreiser. You should know better by now.
I don't think he's going to really hit that well either. I mean, he's pretty consistently run strikeout rates, like you said, up in the 17 to 20% range in the minors, which doesn't portend very well for a contact hitter in the majors. But he does steal when he gets on base. He's got range in the outfield. I don't think he has the arm of Jerrod Dyson, like I said, but he could be a decent plug-in player. He does maybe deserve this extended run with Kiermaier out just to see what happens, but that eventually went south when he was with the Braves and got a little bit of run. He ran into that strikeout rate problem and was only hitting 238 in 2016 in the majors. So that presents some problems, but he's probably worth a shot. I don't know. There are worse guys to run out there. But
like Peter Borges, who...
Yes, like Peter Borges.
So happens to be on that team. Actually, you know what? To Borges' credit, I think he's hitting much better than any of us would have expected. He has like a 94 OPS plus, I want to say, which is above his career norm. And, you know, I guess he just kind of popped to mind too when we were talking about a speedy defense first center fielder / outfielder who has more strikeouts than you would expect given his power wattage. So I wonder, does Malik Smith shiver when he's near Peter Borges? You know, does he get... you know, does he not know why he shivers when he's around him? But yeah, okay, I will accept that they should be giving him the burn. I'm just not sure. Maybe he has Jerrod Dyson, but we'll see.
It took Jerrod Dyson a long time to get playing time, even as Jerrod Dyson.
Yeah.
So that's not necessarily the best outcome. It's just another guy that came to mind
as long as he's not Nathan Haines, you know.
Sure.
So on the topic of Nathan Haines, we'll shift away. going out of the Washington Nationals closing situation, Cody Glover sent to the disabled list, Joe Blanton activated. What are the Nationals going to do for their closing situation? I know a couple weeks ago we mentioned that Tony Watson was a good candidate for them to go out and get. That kind of imploded. What's going on? Are they going to acquire somebody?
They should have just never traded away Felipe Rivero, apparently. I think they almost have to think about acquiring someone before the deadline, maybe not right away. They're not in any desperate straits, but yeah, the bullpen is not great right now. I don't think it's outlandish to think that one of Sean Kelly or Blake Treinen or Annie Romero might turn it around or turn it on at some point and be a better closing option than they look like right now. But they're also just completely without a great reliever right now, which is not something you want when you're a serious contender like they are.
And you look for ways that the Mets could get back into it. It seems like the bullpen might be something that if the Nationals let fester, it could come back to bite them. We've seen it happen to them in the playoffs before. Do you think that they ever address the issue?
Yeah, they'll address it. But I don't know if they're going to address it enough where you feel like it's a strength going into the postseason, just that it's going to be better than it is now. And that might be all that team needs in order to, you know, make a deep run come the postseason, just to get maybe one or two good relievers, you know, Glover come back healthy. You know, as Zach mentioned, they have a few live arms there. Maybe one of them, maybe two of them turning around, and all of a sudden, you know, they have three or four quality relievers to throw out there with Scherzer and, you know, Strasburg and whatever. That might be enough to, you know, get into the NLCS, and we'll see from there. But, yeah, obviously that bullpen is the weakness on a team that's pretty good otherwise.
Yeah, I don't even know. You know, there are a lot of teams where you kind of end up with an extra starter. You know, maybe it on some teams, Joe Ross would be a late season reliever because he is younger and got booted out of the rotation. And then maybe he can go in there, amp his velocity up a little bit and be better than a lot of these options. But I don't really think that's going to happen for the Nats because they traded what prospect starter depth they had for Adam Eaton. The 40-man roster does not inspire confidence that the bullpen's going to fix itself. So,
and in the meanwhile, they have Matt Albers to close out games. So good for Matt Albers.
Good for Matt Albers, indeed.
It's crazy. He had that long streak of never getting a save, and now it seems like he's going to get situations to get saves. So speaking of the White Sox getting young talent, Alan Hansen claimed off waivers from the Pittsburgh Pirates. So does he match this trend of young White Sox infielders?
Yeah, this is an interesting one. You know, obviously the White Sox, despite their early season success, are a rebuilding team, and you know the record's starting to indicate that. And with Hansen, they're getting someone who was a former top prospect, won't turn 25 until later this year. He's a switch hitter. He has some experience at shortstop, although that's not really his best position or the position that you think he's going to play most often. And, you know, why not? I know Yolmer Sanchez is having a surprisingly competent season at the plate. Tim Anderson's struggling, but you're obviously not going to bench him or demote him in favor of Alan Hansen. You know, Lory Garcia has been very, very productive, and that's basically the role that Hansen is going to reprise, is the one that Garcia had at the beginning of the season. So I guess the funny thing here is that Hansen enjoys Willie Garcia as a former Pirates prospect who was claimed off waivers by the White Sox. So, you know, even though the two sides didn't come together on a Jose Quintanilla trade, it seems like the White Sox are going to get a few of those down-the-system prospects anyway to fill out their bench.
Wow, this is educational. I had no idea that Lory Garcia had been productive. That is true. Wow. Okay, so that's basically what you're hoping for with Alan Hansen. You're hoping you accidentally stumble into this guy you're trying to shuffle in for playing time purposes until the Moncada and company group shows up, and then you just accidentally run into a potential above-average player. That's really what, you know, if Alan Hansen gets a spark and goes off like Lory Garcia has, then you keep him around. If not, then he's another waiver claim for someone else in, like, I don't know, 3 weeks. I can't imagine he's going to be unless he really puts it together quickly, I don't think he'll be on the White Sox in a month. Now, maybe that means he'll be on the White Sox AAA team in Charlotte. But, yeah, I think it's just a guy that you give a change of scenery to and hope that something clicks. And if it doesn't, then, you know, you didn't give up anything for him and he can move on somewhere else and give it a shot.
Yeah, and the stuff that needs to click is his hit tool, because he's not someone who's going to walk a lot. He's not someone who's going to hit for much power. So, you know, if Alan Hansen is going to have a big league career, he's going to have to hit for average. The odds of that, you know, they're going to vary by whoever's answering the question, but it's worth a shot. And, you know, what can it hurt? At minimum, they get to make some Hansen references, and that makes everything better in my experience. So,
from a now former Pirate to a now former Pirate, Tyler Glasnow optioned to the minor leagues. He hasn't really done what he had done in minor leagues before 2016 in the majors, but do we think that he's going to go down to the minors, fix his stuff, come back and do well, or do we think that they'll move him to the bullpen going forward?
I think that they're not going to give up the ghost yet on him as a starting pitcher. You know, the wildness was sort of anticipated because he's always been wild. He's a big dude. He is, 6'8", I think, and it takes those guys a little longer to learn how to control their bodies, learn how to harness their deliveries. And you saw throughout his minor league career, I mean, his walk issues are no secret. Last season, he walked 5 for 9 in AAA. So you kind of had to anticipate that he could potentially run up a high walk rate. The concerning part, I guess, is giving up 2 home runs per 9. But, you know, that just speaks to his locational issues. He has good stuff still. There's still a lot of potential here. And, you know, we're talking about Glasnow going down. The other side of this is that Jameson Taillon is going to return 5 weeks after undergoing an operation to have his testicular cancer treated. So, you know, that's a great story there. So, you know, everybody's going to be a little bit sad about Glasnow going down, but it's a great thing that Taillon is back when he is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the interesting thing with Glasnow is just what the next step with him is. I mean, are you looking for him to become – there have been pitchers I've written about, Danny Duffy in the past, who don't possess the world's best control, but what they end up doing is figuring out a way to throw it in the zone and letting their stuff take over in terms of getting whiffs and getting bad contact and not trying to really hit their spots. I'm sure they're trying to hit their spots, but knowing they're not necessarily going to hit the spot and just getting it over the plate somewhere and relying on premium velocity or premium movement to get the job done. And you wonder if that's something, an adjustment that Glasnow might make eventually, or if his stuff is not that. Maybe he was already trying it and he got taken out of the yard a whole bunch this year. But
we're talking about the Matt Thornton strategy. When he went to Chicago, Don Cooper supposedly was just like, throw it down the middle. And, you know, throw it down the middle, your movement's going to take it away from the middle and guys aren't going to be able to hit you. So maybe they should just tell Glasnow, aim for the middle of the plate. And, you know, his movement and his natural erratic in the hand will lead it to the corner, the edge, whatever. It'll at least dodge barrels. So, you know, aim for the middle, Glasnow. Aim for the middle.
Yeah, his zone rate went up this year, but I mean, not. It went up from like worst possible zone rate to 120th out of 182 people who've thrown 500 pitches this year by Baseball Prospectus's page. So it's still not good, and most of the people below him are kind of your control artist types who intentionally miss a little bit and get the calls, and that's very much not what he's doing. So it's you know, he is a huge guy. He's got a ton of potential with his stuff, and I agree that they shouldn't give up on him as a starter just yet. I think a lot of teams in the past have given up a little faster than maybe they should have on guys like him, and maybe you don't reap the maximum rewards if you go full bullpen with him. So, you know, send him down, let him try and figure it out. Maybe he needs a little more confidence after getting rocked a little bit.
Zach, you've written about this. I've touched on it a little bit with the article I wrote about the Astros. You can live with being outside the strike zone. You just can't give up like hard contact when you do, because you can walk people, that's fine, but if when you go into the strike zone you give up just dinger after dinger after dinger, then that comes back to bite you. And if you look at his play discipline stats, people just aren't swinging at his pitches outside the strike zone. No one is chasing. It's well below league average. I think it's 24.2% for pitch FX. People are swinging outside the strike zone. The league average is 30%. So people just aren't chasing his stuff, and he's got to figure out a way to, like you said, get more movement. and entice them to swing at those close pitches. Maybe he's somebody that becomes a Carlos Martinez going forward.
It's a really hard kind of stew to figure out how it happens, but you get these guys that, I mean, I have long been confused by Dallas Keuchel, and I continue to be confused by Dallas Keuchel, but you get these guys who just can constantly throw outside the zone, and even though, you know, undoubtedly hitters are getting scouting reports on the Cy Young winner, and they know that he's not going to throw them anything in the zone, if we're talking about Keuchel, and they're still just incapable of not swinging or incapable of getting in a good count and forcing him to come up. You know, that was happening a little bit last year, but it's gone right away this year. And there's just that interesting mix of reputation and the way that it looks out of his hand. There's just a lot of things that go into that decision of whether hitters swing or not at this stuff that's out of the zone. And some guys have figured out a way to make it work where they throw out of the zone, but they're not getting into these bad counts. And he's got just the total opposite end of the spectrum where he's not getting the early swings and he's being forced to come in and throw something, you know, right down the middle or up, and it's getting crushed later in the zone. So it's just really, really tricky to figure out how you get him over to that other side. And it might be that he's not that type of pitcher who can throw out of the zone. It might be that he's got to figure out a way to keep it in the box and make people swing.
It's the Greg Maddux saying, you know, make your strikes look like balls, make your balls look like strikes.
And from Greg Maddux, we move to Andrew Triggs, one of the same, right? For the Oakland Athletics, he's going to the disabled list with a hip injury. So he was a guy that we actually named an episode after earlier in this year. Very, very big fans of him at this show. So what do we see the Athletics doing with him going forward? And will he bounce back from that high ERA?
He's probably getting a mental rest as much of anything. You know, over his last four starts, 18 and two-thirds innings, 32 hits allowed, 26 runs, albeit only 20 earned, 7 walks, 15 strikeouts, 7 home runs. That's a 381, 415, 667 line against. He's just been getting walloped, and, you know, not even necessarily by, I mean, it was against the Red Sox, the Yankees, the Nationals, and the Rays. I mean, it's sad. I don't think any of us expected him to continue to pitch like the 2.12 ERA pitcher he was in mid-May, but it's disappointing because, you know, he's a fun story. He has a fun style. You don't usually see pitchers with his mechanics or his stuff get prolonged opportunities in a big league rotation. So I'm hoping he comes back and pitches good enough to maintain a rotation spot, but ideally good enough so we can continue to talk about him for years to come. Unfortunately, this might be, when we look back upon his career, the beginning of the end of his time as a starting pitcher, because he's just been getting – I mean, guys have just been jumping the yard against him. The last two times out, he's given up 5 home runs in like 7 innings. So it's sad because, again, I really love his story. I really love the oddballs of baseball, particularly as pitchers, and he's one of the oddest balls, you know, one of the oddest balls in the league. But yeah, this seems like a nice little wake up call for all of us who are in love with trigonometry.
I think he's actually just hurt. His velocity went down, especially right around the Boston start, which is, I think, like a month ago. And, his horizontal release point has changed, just went crazy around that same time, up and down and back and forth. I don't know. I tend to think this might just be an injury issue. I mean, his fastball is obviously not fast anyway. And the idea of him losing a tick, which he has from last year and even from early this season, I think there might be something to the idea that he is injured and that that tick might make a bigger difference for him than for a lot of guys because he was pretty low on the scale to begin with.
Yeah.
But I don't know how bad the injury is. I'm not a doctor or a mind reader, so I can't tell you if it actually matters that much. But it seems like, you know, if he could get healthy quickly, or if there's just something where he needs a little bit of time off to come back, I don't necessarily think that he's any different than he was. I think he might just be hurt, but that's kind of an optimistic-ish view of it.
I'm a quantum physicist, Zach, and I hope you're right, because yeah, I really would like the thought of him returning and being a productive pitcher, productive starter, in 2 weeks' time, or however long it takes for him to recover from this injury. So
we move from Andrew Triggs to Edwin Jackson and Brandon Morrow, both guys we've talked about last week, and both guys now optioned to the minors. So which one is going to return quicker? And is this the end of the line for Edwin Jackson?
It will never be the end of the line for Edwin Jackson, Brody. I mean, you have to go with Brandon Morrow. He's actually performed, you know, in six innings. He struck out seven batters, only walked one. He's allowed two hits, no runs, no home runs, you know, none of that nonsense. So I think you have to qualify this as a successful stint for him in the majors, and he'll be back. You know, Edwin Jackson, I'm so annoyed that I missed the Edwin Jackson show. I mean, geez Louise, you only get so many opportunities to talk about this guy debuting for a new team, and I missed the latest one, so I'm annoyed with that. I hope he gets back, though. You know, Jackson has a reputation of being a very likable individual, and, you know, I mean, they got their money's worth out of him. He appeared in three games, and he wasn't good. I mean, I'm not saying he's good, but I really do hope that he finds a way to get to that 13th team and ties Octavio Dotel's record, because he won't turn 34 until September. If he just puts together like 10, 15 good innings one of these years, he's got another 2 or 3 years on top of that, you know? So we really might be talking about someone who could appear for 15 teams if he doesn't decide, you know what, I've had enough of this bus riding in AAA. I've had enough of these, you know, random call-ups. I'm going to retire with all the money I've made and go enjoy my life without having to worry about being the butt of all these Twitter jokes and all these blog posts that compare me to Octavio Dotel and whomever else. So I hope he gets to at least 14, maybe 15, but realistically, he's probably about fed up with this whole song and dance.
Oh, I think the 10-day DL has almost guaranteed that he's going to break the record. I think he'll get a shot. I also would like to note that it's looking good for my side of the wager with Brian that Jackson has already been sent back down, and Ruben Tejada remains on the roster. So hoping that I keep that one together. If either one of them makes it to August 1st, that'll be something. But either way, I'm looking good. No, I think Edwin Jackson is probably, I don't know if it'll be with the Orioles, although it's hard to think of a team that needs pitching more. I think he'll probably get another shot in the majors this year. I think he'll probably get a shot in the majors next year, and maybe the year after that. And if he does it with a couple different teams, then he has a nice little record on his hands, which, good for him. He will have been memorable doing it.
It's quite an odd lot in life to be constantly compared to Octavio Dotel, right? I mean,
some of us would consider that a compliment, Brody. I would give up quite a bit to be compared to Octavio Dotel instead of whomever in the world I am compared to. So,
so moving on to our last segment now, the Twins purchased the contract of Nick Turley.
Yeah, so we were just talking about Triggs as a fascinating story. And Turley might just be as fascinating, if not more fascinating, because he was originally a 50th round pick in 2008. He climbed prospect lists as a teenager, and then he just kind of disappeared. Then, you know, he resurfaced. He was with the Giants minor league system in 2015. He pitched in, I believe, independent leagues in 2016, as well as Boston system. He was with the Twins earlier this year in their minor league system. Pitched very well in double and triple A. Now he's in the majors, and, you know, it's a really fascinating story. I'm not quite sure what to make of him. You know, just to list off his minor league numbers this season, 14.4 strikeouts per nine, a sub-3 walk rate. He gave up two home runs in 52 and two-thirds innings. You know, then he comes to the majors, and in his first appearance, four innings, eight hits, four runs allowed, four strikeouts. So in theory, you know, putting an extreme fly ball pitcher in front of that outfield defense is going to be a good thing. But there's also a reason he is a 27-year-old rookie who we really hadn't thought of as a legitimate prospect in 4 years, maybe five. I'm not even sure, to be honest with you. So it's been a little while since we've thought of Nick Turley. And, you know, hopefully he gives us more reason to think about him in the near future.
You know, it's interesting. I'm looking at his page, and there was very little reason to think of him as a good prospect from the time he got to the pros until he at some point switched from the Giants to the Red Sox. And when he did that, he had 20 games in 2016 in AA with the Red Sox, and he only started two of them, which he'd started almost every outing prior to that. And that's when his strikeout rate went through the roof. And when he went back to starting, it looks like he maintained that pretty well, and the walks have been reasonably low. So I don't know. Maybe he's a guy who got the bullpen bump and learned something and has brought it back to the rotation. It's still only been like 50 innings since that happened.
Right.
Or so. So it's a very small sample, but
well, in fairness, you know, just to note, like the reason he had slipped in the draft was due to a Mormon mission that he ended up skipping. But you know, his story when he was younger is that he could become a back of the rotation arm due to his feel for pitching, and you know, he had a good changeup for his age and all those things. And nowadays he actually throws fairly hard for a left-hander. I think he's clocked in at like 93, 94 miles per hour, somewhere in that range.
He averaged 92.6.
There we go.
In a big league start.
There we go. So yeah, he's. I don't know. It's interesting. Usually, if you throw in, usually if you can touch the mid 90s in your left hand, you're going to get a few big league opportunities. So, like we just talked about with Edwin Jackson, how the 10-day disabled list has kind of necessitated that he'll get a few more opportunities. My guess is that Nick Turley is not on his last big league stint, even if he's on his first big league stint. And my guess is that Nick Turley is not pitching for his last big league organization, even if this is his first big league roster. So just hoping again that Nick Turley gives us sufficient reason to talk about him in future episodes of this podcast.
So sticking with the draft theme, draft is tonight. So this will be posted the morning after the draft, but who is the number one overall pick for y'all?
You are, Sean.
I am. You pick a D3 pitcher coming off of Tommy John.
You have a big heart. Heart height doesn't measure heart, as Marcus Stroman says. So.
Oh.
Health doesn't measure heart either.
There we go. There we go.
Oh, so I think that's a great spot to end it. So, RJ, wrap us up.
Yeah. Thank you, Sean. Yes. So you can obviously catch Mr. Kreiser at Baseball Prospectus. Sean Brody on his Twitter profile, as well as BP Mets and Beyond the Box Score. You can catch Elliot Brody driving rare, you know, various vehicles down the highway. And you can find me on CBS Sports. We thank you for your continued support, and we'll catch you next time.